The handout is a topical Sunday school, a one-shot deal that I'm doing. Don't read too much into the topic, please. How to love difficult people is the topic. I did this in Jaffrey, and I've done it a couple other places. I'm not going to just lecture. I'm going to solicit feedback or questions, so raise your hand or shout out, whatever, to get my attention. To start with some thinking, hopefully you all realize that God has given us two forms of revelation. And God is the author of all revelation. So all of God's revelation is inerrant, infallible. Hopefully you know what those two forms of revelation are. The written one, and then the world that God has created. So it's not wrong to say, you know, by experience I've noticed something about the world and about people in it. So I'm going to be using some, let's call it, sanctified common sense, and I would offer that as something that's not inerrant, infallible, but it is something that's valuable. But I'm also going to turn to Scripture. These ideas came from a booklet, the CCF booklet on how to love difficult people. So I give credit to the CCF people for developing various materials on how to interact with one another. But I've also added to that, so this is not 100% their work. So if you like it, give them credit. If you don't like it, give me the blame. All right, what kind of difficult people have you experienced? And I've, you know, sanctified common sense, come up with some different kinds of difficult people that you may have experienced. And we can choose all categories. You could choose family members, you know, your spouse, your coworker, your boss. If you're in school, you could say teachers. I've had difficult teachers. You can expand it. Churches can be difficult. But I'm thinking mostly in terms of personal relationships we have. You can have just difficult people who are nasty. They're verbally offensive or socially offensive. I mean, they're just nasty. And these kinds of people may not even know how nasty they are. They may be sort of naturally proud or arrogant, and they may have reasons for being proud. They might be extraordinarily gifted in some way. You can pick almost any kind of skill. Musicians who are really good can be arrogant. Pastors who are really smart can be arrogant. People in science or work who are very good at what they do can be kind of arrogant. And you may find those people offensive, verbally and otherwise. And I'm not talking about, you know, people who swear, just people who are just sort of, I don't know, prickly or something. All right, so that's one kind of difficult person. Then there's the kind of person who's difficult, and it's not necessarily that they're nasty. These are people who are either unskilled or weak. And, you know, if you think of all the various kinds of people you interact with, there are some people who are just handicapped. I mean, take an extreme example. Deaf people, blind people are difficult, not in the sense of being sinful or arrogant, but they're just difficult. How do you deal with someone who's deaf? If you don't know sign language, it's really hard. They might read lips, they might be able to speak if they've been taught how to speak, but it's really hard to interact with a deaf person. Add blindness to that, deaf-blind person, very difficult. I have a son who has Down syndrome. He's 21, and he has a reading capability of about a second grade level. If you interact with him, sometimes his speech is unclear, and so you have to get him to slow down to understand him. That's a weakness. That's not a sin. Let me give you a dramatic example of how it could be difficult for a person with a weakness or a lack of skill to respond. Let's suppose there's a deaf person walking down the street and there's some policeman saying, stop or I'll shoot. Deaf person doesn't hear the command. That's pretty serious. So we need to understand there are people who are nasty, there are people who are weak or unskilled, people from other cultures. Take somebody from Eastern Europe or somebody from Italy, you know, off the boat, Italian, they're going to come and probably want to pinch you and hug you and all this kind of stuff as they get to know you. Maybe you're Northern European and you're like, no, thank you very much. So there's a lack of social skills that can make it difficult. We just don't know different cultures sometimes. So that can be a problem, make it difficult to love the person in the sense of, you know, what is this person all about? And then you have people who are just plain sinful. Now, I'm going to define sin in this way. It's someone who deliberately decides to hurt you. They may hurt you emotionally, they may hurt you financially, they may hurt you physically, but they have deliberately chosen to hurt you. I once had a boss when I was in business, and he took delight in bringing his secretary to tears. He enjoyed it. He deliberately figured out how to bring her to tears. I'm not going to get into like how or what he did, but it was just vicious. And so there are people that are difficult to deal with in that sense. Then I've got three other categories, which I think are sort of subcategories of the others, but you have complainers, people who just don't like anything. Now that's a little bit different from the next one, but you know, people, it's like, you know, what's the Eeyore kind of thing? Oh, it's such a bad day. How are you doing? It's just awful. And you know, that can be really difficult to hear. They're just never satisfied. Nothing good ever happens. Then there are the perfectionists who, they may have a great day, but they may always find fault in something. They may not complain, but you know, it's never quite, you know, my wife accuses me of this sometimes. We'll have a conversation, and not necessarily theological conversation or spiritual conversation, and I'll find something in the vocabulary that she used that was just not the right word, and I'll point it out. So I'm difficult to deal with there. She says, you're just being technical. I said, well, you know, I'm a pastor. I have to be a nitpicker theologically. I've got to get all the I's dotted, T's crossed to get the theology right. Unfortunately, that carries over into sort of casual conversations. So perfectionists, always finding fault. These people are difficult to deal with. And then the last one I listed here was self-centered people. I won't name names. I've got several brothers. But one of my brothers has a favorite topic, and it's him and his family. And that's about it. You talk to him in, you know, family reunions or whatever, and it's like, you'll learn all about him and his family, but he won't ask about me and my family or my other two brothers. You know, this is the kind of thing that somebody who's somehow just very self-centered, not sinfully so maybe, but just all they want to talk about. And they don't listen usually. So they're talk, 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 and then they don't give you an opportunity to say anything, or they don't draw you out. And again, these are not necessarily sinful things. They may be character traits. They sometimes are cultural. Sometimes family background makes it. But those are types of difficult people. And I'm sure you have your own type that you probably confront or come across that hopefully would fit into one of these. Now, the second point here on the handout is, how do we often deal with difficult people? And I'm going to emphasize that sometimes we deal sinfully with difficult people. First one is to avoid them. Here comes Joe. What a pain. I'm going to cross the street or just, you know, I won't look at him. I won't, you know, you ignore them or flat out avoid them. And we'll see why this is sinful in a little bit later. The other is to gossip. You know, did you hear what Steve did at Sunday school? You know, you wouldn't believe it, you know. So you gossip about them. And gossip, I think, is considered to be a sin in Scripture. Now, it's interesting to try to figure out what the definition of gossip is. My definition, which is not inerrant infallible, is to say something that's true about someone else that tears them down. In other words, you're not lying. He really did say such and such on Sunday school, and what an idiot he was, right? And so you repeat the sin that the other person committed for your own pleasure and the shared pleasure of seeing somebody torn down. That's my definition of gossip. There may be others where you would include lying about the other person. So think about it. Isn't it fun in some sinful way to say what the difficult person did? Now, a third point here under how do we deal often with difficult people is we try to control them or manipulate them so that they aren't too difficult. Parents sometimes do this with children. I do this with my children who are teenagers and above. How do you try to control them? There's many, 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 many ways to do this, and I won't try to get into all of them, but let's just say to control them would be to, well, I guess in conversation would be to interrupt if it's a bad conversation. If you know, I'll use sort of a secular term, if you know how to push the other person's buttons, you might realize that they don't respond to anger too well. So you might realize, if I get angry at my son, he's going to do what I say, or my spouse, or whatever. Or you might try to control them with bribes, candy, you name it. Husbands and wives often have ways of saying, you know, if you're nice to me, you'll have your best meal or whatever. Difficult people you can try to control, and that's a difficult thing to undo, especially because it often works. Understand, a difficult person is unpleasant to be with, and so if you're trying to avoid an unpleasant situation, you might figure out how to control that. Last one is, how do you deal with difficult people? And I just figured quarrel, fights. we have fights, don't we? And so whether that's at work or school or with coworkers or playmates or whatever, neighbors, you might have a quarrel with them. And those can vary anywhere from simply shouting, raising your voice, to, I remember one man telling me he was doing marriage counseling with a couple, and they said they had really serious fights. And he said, well, that's really too bad. Can you give me a little more definition of what that is? And it turned out they actually shot guns. One of them shot at the other person and fired a pistol inside the house at the other person. Hopefully that you don't have that kind of a quarrel, but it'd be interesting to counsel someone like that. I suppose the ultimate way to deal with a difficult person is murder. I think that's a little extreme, but okay, so those are some difficult people. This is how we often deal with people sinfully who are difficult. Now, here's point three on the first page. Now, hopefully you believe this, that we are all hard to love in some way. God hasn't loved us because we're lovable. And God doesn't continue to love us because we're lovable. God has set his love on us. So we are sinfully unlovable and we are sinfully difficult to deal with. And so God, our Heavenly Father, has chosen to love us and to do good to us. Now that is the core of Christianity, the core of the gospel. And God's acceptance and God's relationship with us is completely undeserved from start to finish. Until the day I die, in some way I will be a sinner and you will too. And so there will be sin in you and I until the day we die. And there will always be that which is repulsive to God. Yet he loves us. And God knows you through and through, knows me through and through. But he has deliberately chosen to love difficult people like you and I. You know, the quotes there from Romans or Isaiah, we have all gone astray, no one is righteous, no, not one. Think about that in terms of relationships. If you believe that about yourself, in terms of God's relationship with you, and you believe it about your relationship with other people, that you have indeed, I have indeed, sinned against other people, been extremely difficult to deal with, all my own fault, that should help us as we think about how we are to love one another. All right, so the first step in loving difficult people, it's in bold here. Ask God to show you how hard it is to love you or for you to be loved by others. And then ask God to forgive you, and hopefully you will be better able to give grace, undeserved love and grace to others because you know you've received it from God. Quick little story on myself. Before I became a Christian in my 30s, and before that, I was arrogant, obnoxious at work, successful, a workaholic, and I didn't really know how bad it was until one day there was a crisis in the office, and I was dealing with a particular company that had a problem that my coworker was supposed to handle, and she couldn't handle it. So you get the setup. She's not doing it. I'm arrogant. I'm successful. I'm the know-it-all. So what I basically did, again, pre-Christian, but you could probably have this happen as a Christian, I pushed her aside very ungently and just said, I'll take over and do this. And my boss told me it drove her to tears when I did that. Here I am saying, I'm just doing the work. This is a crisis. We have to solve this problem for this company, you know. In hindsight, as a Christian, I looked at that and I said, the way I did it was extremely obnoxious. Arrogant, proud, aggressive, controlled the situation. I just blew her off in a sense. Get out of my way, I'll handle this. So if you have any personal history like that where you could actually pray to God, God, show me where I've been extraordinarily difficult. Not just in a, yeah, I know everybody's difficult, me too, but show me, bring to my mind, you know, do this in silent prayer with yourself at home where you've got some time to just say, God, show me some things that I've done in the past. Some people who I've treated very unlovingly and was very difficult in that relationship. And you can include marriage, family, you can work, whatever. And let God bring that to your mind. If you don't do that, you're going to come, you know, say, oh, well, yeah, I guess I've done some things wrong. No, but my suggestion is wait on the Lord to show you in your private time with Him where you've been the difficult person in some relationship. Okay, then we go on to the second half of the first page. It's important to have God's goal for difficult relationships. And you probably already know God, through Christ, has said, love your enemies, right? God pursues us. Think about that. God pursues us. We are difficult people. God pursues difficult, rebellious, sinful people. Both before and after you become a Christian. You're a difficult person. I'm a difficult person. He pursues us for our good. And He pursues us with wisdom, grace, power. And He wants us to be wise, gracious, and godly or Christ-like. That's God's agenda, if you will, in a broad sense. Your goal and my goal with dealing with difficult people should be the same. That they would become wise, Christ-like, godly people. Now, if they're unbelievers, that's a long step, but that's still the goal. In other words, think about the normal goal we would have. I just want to get by. I want to get along. I have my agenda. If it's work or home, let's just have peace. You know, peace at any price. Forget about God's goal. We just want peace here. Or here's a good one. I just want to be loved. This difficult person is not loving me. So why can't my agenda be to be more loved by my spouse, my children, my brothers and sisters, whoever? And think about that. That's a very self-centered, not a sinful goal, but God's goal is for you and I to love difficult people, to help them to become more Christ-like, more godly. Okay, so have God's goal for difficult relationships. Next, number two, how does God pursue people? How does God pursue people? Well, we know He did it by sending His Son to become one of us. And His Son never became a difficult person to be one of us in that sense. He never became sin, but He was fully human. Christ was fully human. He knew exactly by experience what it was like to be pressured to sin. This comes out of Hebrews, where Jesus is our great high priest. He knows what it's like to be in this sinful, broken world and to have all the pressures to sin, temptations. But He did not sin. So Christ is sympathetic. Now, we don't always think about that, perhaps, but Christ is fully human, fully sympathetic with what it's like to be a difficult, sinful person, but not being one Himself. That's who Jesus is. That's the encouragement we have in Hebrews, that He is like us in every way, knew temptation, but didn't sin, and He is sympathetic. Now, that in Hebrews, it's an encouragement for you and I to eagerly go to God through Jesus to receive grace and help in our time of need, because He's not ignorant of what it's like to be tempted. So it's kind of like, okay, you know, in an earthly sense, who would you go to if you needed help? You wouldn't go to a difficult person, an unsympathetic person. When you're brokenhearted or whatever, you go to the person who you think has the most sympathy, most compassion with you, the person who's going to come alongside you and not beat you up, so to speak. You want an emotional verbal hug, or maybe a literal hug from the person when you're broken. Okay? Sympathetic. Empathetic. Imagine the greatest tool you have to deal with a difficult person is that you could be sympathetic with them. You can't have sympathy with somebody you have no idea what they're about. So, Jesus knows what it's like for us to struggle. One of the goals we should all have with any difficult person, Christian or non, is to get to know them. God pursues us. He knows us thoroughly, sent His Son, and simple gospel. His Son loved us unto death on the cross to reconcile us with the Father and so forth. Now, we're not expected to lay down our lives for our enemies, but we are expected to love our enemies. And so we are expected to do good to difficult people. The promises of God are that He will be our protector, that He will provide for us, food, shelter, clothing, that we have a destiny that's perfect, so our security is not in this world, but in the world to come. So we always have a future orientation as Christians. So, for example, I wrote it down here, but God is our protector, our fortress, our shield, our refuge, our stronghold. So God gives us safety. Now, what do you need when you go to your enemy and you're going to do good to your enemy? Or you're going to go to that difficult person? You need to have a sense that God is going to protect you. That whatever pain comes in this difficult person's life towards you, God will sustain you, give you grace, give you help to love the difficult person, to love the person who may have hurt you. So it begins with understanding God, who God is for us as Christians. If your God is remote, doesn't have any clue what's going on in your life, and you're like all alone going to deal with a difficult person, you're likely to not do well. And you're likely to not even do it in the first step of trying to get to know the difficult person beyond just their difficulty. Let me pause here. Any questions or comments? I think that the element of truth I would accent in what you said is that when we sin or someone else sins, I don't think any of us know the gravity of it. We do not really feel the wickedness of our own sin when we do it. And I don't think, for example, the simple, silly example I gave, but real, when I was in the workforce and this person was, you know, not doing well and I just pushed her aside, I thought I was just doing a great thing. I'm the hero. I'm the Lone Ranger coming to the rescue of this problem. And I did solve the problem, but this person just got pushed aside and I had no clue that I drove her crazy, drove her to tears until my boss told me. So I think there is a certain sense of ignorance about it, but that ignorance doesn't excuse the sin. And there are people who sometimes, like I mentioned, the boss who liked to bring a secretary, he knew what he was doing. There are people who are fully conscious of what they're doing. You know, the difference between premeditated murder and manslaughter, you know, the world says there's a difference in those kinds of crimes. So I think there is some sense that we would recognize that as Christians too. Okay, turn over the sheet. I'm going to try to get practical here. I hate how-to kinds of Sunday schools, but this is one where I'm going to go, yeah, here's a how-to. How to do it. And these are things that I think are helpful. Practical strategies for change. That's for us to change so that we can love difficult people in a better way. Number one, admit your own failings. And, you know, the classic passage for that is Matthew 7. So let me read it. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye when there is the log in your own eye? You hypocrite. First, take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Now, just a couple comments on that. Sometimes we take scripture and we leave it in one sense and don't have the full sense. The full sense of this, I think, is you and I have bad eyesight because of our own sins. When we look at someone else, we always tend to be harsh to them and gracious to ourselves in a sense. Like, I'm not really that bad, so we don't think we've got this problem seeing. But the context here is the other person does have a problem. And you are called to remove your own problem in seeing so that you see clearer because you see your own sin. You get right with that, so to speak, as best you can. And then you can see the other person's problem. So it's not like you just ignore the other person's problem. Their sin is not something you ignore. It's that you deal with your own sinful desires, whatever, first. And Jesus says, and then go and help the other person with their sin. So it's not like, oh, just give up. Because I'm a sinner, I can't do anything. That's not it. Paul's an example of a blasphemer, a persecutor of Christians. And it's very interesting how Paul actually brings that up. He read his letters and he reminds those churches that he started of his own failures. Imagine me, well, like I just did in a small way, how I was an arrogant, obnoxious coworker and caused this other person to be humiliated. I did that. Imagine every time I came here and did something, said, you know, I'm a blasphemer. I did this and, you know, I was wicked and, you know, I've broken the Ten Commandments and, you know, maybe I could tell you the Ten Commandments I broke, and all of a sudden you're realizing this guy's really wicked. Paul does that. He's doing it not arrogantly, but he's saying, look at the grace of God in me. And he's remembering his own wickedness as almost like a self-motivating thing to say, look at the grace that God has given to me. And he writes to those churches, you know, the Corinthians who are wacky and, you know, crazy and so forth. So, use this carefully. But if you do admit your own failings to yourself, you might also admit it to someone else. So, for example, if there's a difficult person, you know, with care and with wisdom, you might say to that difficult person, I'm difficult too, in this specific way. Think about sympathy. The people who can most sympathize with me, with my handicapped son, are people who have handicapped children. We don't have to explain things. So if you say to a difficult person, I'm difficult too, maybe in the same way he or she is, you might gain some sympathy with that person. Now, this might not happen like that. It might take time. But that's an opportunity for you to admit out loud your own failings, sins. And perhaps as a Christian witness, say how being a Christian has helped you. In my own spiritual pilgrimage, whatever, I had an interesting background in the sense that when I became a Christian in my 30s, there were certain character defects, we'll call them sins, that I had that went away like that. Not all of them, but there were a couple that just sort of vaporized. And I actually had a close friend who knew me very well, and she said, I like the new Steve, but I don't trust him yet. I thought, oh, okay. In other words, it was like black and white, the change. And I won't tell you exactly what it was, but this same person I once swung at out of anger. Mister, thank God. So she noticed the difference, lack of swinging and so forth. But there are also other things that happened in my life that took years and years of struggles to get over. And, you know, by the grace of God now, those sins are pretty much behind me. So both those kinds of things, if you admit them to someone who's a difficult person, again, you want to get sympathy, but you don't want to just leave them like, oh yeah, we're all bad, so let's stay bad. That's not what you want to do. You want to be sympathetic and maybe bring in how the gospel has helped you. Okay, that's number one. Any comments on that? It's a how-to kind of thing based on Matthew chapter 7 and other parts of Scripture, Paul, etc. Number two is very important. Pursue the other person for their sake. This is very, very important. Ask yourself, what does this other difficult person need? Don't ask, what do they want or what do I want for them? I might want my children to be scholars and doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, whatever, that kind of thing. I may want them to be that, but that might not be what they need in their life to have that kind of pressure. So be very careful to have the agenda be, what does the other person need? And again, think of sympathy, the sympathy of Christ. Think of all the aspects of need. And my way of describing love is that love is doing good to another person. You might not like that other person. How can you like your enemy, somebody who's brutalized you or hurt you? But you are to do good to that enemy. And think about this also. Loving a person is not like a cookie cutter thing where you just say, okay, yep, here's my cookies, you know. Same shape, same answer for everybody. Love your enemy. It's always the same. It's not. Think about loving your own family members. If you're a parent or you have a 2-year-old, loving your 2-year-old hopefully looks a lot different than loving your 20-year-old or your 13-year-old or your 17-year-old. So part of love is the wisdom to know what is good for her or him in their place right now. And so we don't always, at least I don't always think of this, love requires wisdom from God. James says, you lack wisdom, ask God to give you it. You and I need wisdom from God to know how to do good to other people because we don't know what the good is half the time. What is the right word or action to do something good for the difficult person? It's not a how-to, like, instant answer. So again, don't pursue others for their sake, for their good, and that might not mean letting them get away with some sin. Okay, number three, remember the other person's good and their growth. When you're frustrated, notice I said when, not if. When you're frustrated and tired of the other person's sin or difficulty, try to remember they're not just a sinner. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. Hopefully you believe the scriptural truth that every human being is made in the image of God, believer and unbeliever. To choose an extreme example, Adolf Hitler was made in the image of God. He probably loved his dog and his mistress in a nice way. Saddam Hussein probably had something in his personality that was in the image of God. You have to look hard for it sometimes in some of these men because we only think of their sins. So when you're dealing with the difficult person, don't just see, now here's an angry person or here's a man who swears all the time. Try to see beyond that. In literature, if somebody writes a novel, sometimes they describe the novel in terms of the characters being well-rounded. And the well-rounded character is one that seems more human as opposed to cartoonish. Think of every human being as well-rounded. Yes, they're a sinner. Yes, they're difficult. But somewhere in that human being is something that reflects the image of God in them. So be careful about labeling people. You know, he's a pervert or he's an angry person. Now, that may be something that's true about them, and that may be a dominant part of their life. Alcoholic. The reason we call an alcoholic is because they live for alcohol. They seem to be dominated by alcohol. Now, I've had experience in my life, both in the church and before, dealing with alcoholics, and it's very hard for an alcoholic to get out of that addiction, and so they tend to be pigeonholed as an alcoholic, whereas you can also see maybe the person is a musician, maybe he's got some technical skills that are valuable, maybe he's a really nice person in some other way. So be careful about, as we might call it, pigeonholing somebody, as he's defined as only difficult. So you may see their sin very clearly, but try to see beyond just the obvious sin in his or her life of the difficult person and see them as a human being. Okay? I'll stop there. Any comments or questions? Yes? Don't want to get into literature too much, but there are tragedies, you know, Hamlet and so forth by Shakespeare, that play. People try to look at the character flaw in Hamlet and say that's the reason he's a tragic figure. Hamlet, you know, the character's fiction. But he had a lot of redeeming, or he's a well-rounded character in Shakespeare. So well-rounded human beings would be ones that you don't simply look at their flaw. Yeah. Yeah, don't just look at the character flaw in the difficult person. That's what I would say. And I used the literature analogy just because that was on my mind for some other reason. Any other thoughts or comments? Yeah. Right. There are people who need to be arrested and put in jail. There's a member of Jaffrey Presbyterian Church who's in jail right now. He was arrested. He's pleaded guilty. He'll get between 5 and 20 years for his crime. It's a good thing he was arrested. I won't get into details. His wife is legally separated from him. She's moved back home. I'm not going to go into details. Think about how God uses the police and the judicial system of any nation as his ministers. Paul in Romans 13 says, these are God's ministers. They could be pagan. The Roman Empire was pagan. So Paul was referring to the empire that existed in his day. They, Caesar, Roman governors, are God's ministers to execute justice, which meant catch the criminal, punish him or her. I think the death penalty is a valid way to punish murder, as long as you know absolutely it's murder. You know, the biblical way of looking at murders, you got two or three witnesses and so forth. But that certainly severs a relationship. Now, between that, there's, you know, take child molesters, other kinds of things, where severing the relationship is good. So there are extremes where the person needs to be put in jail. Don't go too far with this, but one of the things I talk about, and if I ever do marriage counseling for people I'm going to marry, I say, you know, let's talk about submission and the husband's authority over the wife and anything. So let me just give you one piece of advice. And I turn to the wife in the couple's presence. I turn to the wife and say, if he ever hits you, call 911. Don't call me. And I meant it. That is not a sinful thing to do. It's appropriate to use various kinds of God-given authorities to protect the weak, whether that's children or a spouse or whatever. So keep in mind, this love your enemy does not mean you have to become a doormat and take sin from that other person. That is not what we're talking about. Okay? Sometimes the best thing for the other person is for you to remove yourself from that relationship. The man who's in jail is legally separated from his wife, and if he gets 5 to 20 years, he's not going to be around, probably. I mean, he's not going to be around for 5 years at least. So that relationship is severed. What happens at the end of that 5 years of prison or 20 years? I don't know. I do not know. And it's okay to not know. All right? That's a difficult question, but I think that's a wise answer to say, you know, you do not have to be a doormat with difficult people at work or church or wherever. Okay, number 4 on the handout on the second page. Care about what's best or better for the other person. Hopefully those of us who are married understand it's not a 50-50 relationship in marriage. You know, you're good to me, Faye, my wife's Faye. You're good to me, Faye, and I'll be good to you, you know. It's not 50-50. We're not sort of in a contract where, you know, you give me a nice meal and I'll give you a whatever and, you know, or whatever, you know. Oh, you had your vacation last year, I get my vacation this year, I get to, you know. There's wisdom in doing those kinds of things, but it's not 50-50 where you're constantly negotiating in the sense of, you gave me this. You're like an accountant, you know, you got your income and you got your debts. So you're not doing that sort of balancing of a spreadsheet or a financial statement, emotional financial statement. Don't do that with other people. So the way I put it in this handout is try to do what's good for the other person without getting anything in return. No strings attached. In marriage counseling, both the spouses have an agenda for the other person. If only he would be better this way, if only she would be better that way, we'd get along. You know, if he changes, you know, but if she changes, you know, that kind of thing. That goes on in any relationship. Try to not do that. Try to be careful about demanding anything in return. This is called sacrificial love. Just do good to the other person. No strings attached. Nothing in return. You do good to the other person because it's good for them. Mothers and fathers tend to do that with their children. How many of you think, wow, I'm going to take care of Johnny because when he grows up, he's going to help me in my retirement? Or, you know, whatever. I mean, children, especially infants, got an infant over there. How much does an infant give back? Well, there's that, you know, they're cute and cuddly and, you know, I suppose they have nice things, but they're totally dependent on mom and dad. Totally dependent. What do they give you back? Well, maybe they have a smile and they coo and they recognize you and so forth. But financially, or in the, you know, sometimes children grow up and they're the biggest pain you have ever had in your entire life. I was one to my parents in many ways. What do you get back? Sometimes you get back something later, but you try not to put that sort of what's in it for me into your relationship with a difficult person. I already mentioned this, but knowing what's best for the other person requires wisdom. It is not an easy thing to know how to help an alcoholic or someone else that's sort of addicted or whatever. We have a woman in our church now who has a 40-year-old adult son who's been in and out of prison. He's on a sex offender list, can't find a job, comes home, wants to live with mom and dad at 40, borrows the car, doesn't return it, gets in an accident, borrows money. You know, you can imagine they're living in a house that's rental. The landlord finds out there's 3 people in the house, illegal according to the, okay, everybody's out or the son's out. How do you love a 40-year-old who's like a loser? Do you constantly give him money? I mean, these are difficult things. But anyway, let's turn to James. James has a very important passage about your desires. What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Right, difficult people, people we have fights with, right? What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet, you cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask, and you ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. Now, how many of you would feel comfortable with a prayer like this to God? God, do whatever it takes to get me to love that angry, nasty person at the office. I want you to help me to do just that. Forget what I want. It's not wrong to want to have a successful career. It's not wrong to want to have a happy marriage. But how many of you would pray this prayer of your marriages? You know, God, help me to love my spouse the way Christ has loved me, sacrificially, willingly, with wisdom and grace for the other person, regardless of what he or she does. In other words, the point here is our own agenda, our own desires can often be what causes problems in relationships. Okay? That's not a debatable point, by the way. It is always a factor. What causes quarrels and what causes fights? Your own desires. Last point on this page is class. Love the person with patience. And where do we get this kind of patience from? We get it from God. Love the other person, the difficult person, with patience, endurance, and your patience, your endurance, your encouragement may never come from the difficult person. So where are you going to get it? Because you do need it. You get it from God. So your relationship with God through Christ is essential in the sense of you've got to be patient with the difficult person. You've got to have some strength. You know, we can always think about, oh, this person sucks the life out of me. And there are people that are like that. We had a person come to the church in Jaffrey who was, if you know the term, borderline personality. It's actually a clinical diagnosis. It's a person who always, 100% of their relationships are burnt over and destroyed. And it's never their fault. They're the kind of person, if you give them a ride somewhere, they're going to jump out of the car and then sue you. And that's a joke, but it's the kind of person, borderline personality person. How are you going to endure that kind of a person that sort of sucks the life out of you? How are you going to have the wisdom and strength to say no in an appropriate good way and feel good about it, even though the person's saying, but you're a Christian, you won't give me whatever. So that kind of strength you need to understand is what you need to endure perhaps a difficult relationship for a long time. And you have to get it from God. Don't call me. I put down Ephesians 3, 14 to 19 here. So the idea here at the end is to pray Ephesians chapter 3, 14 to 19 before you give up. Let me read it and we'll end with this. For this reason I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth is named, that according to the riches of his glory he may grant you to be strengthened with power through his Spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. Now, there's a lot in that passage, but think about praying that in the context of a difficult person to deal with. You need to pray that God would show you his love in your heart, that you would feel and experience that you are profoundly loved by God and Christ. That allows you to love these difficult people. Questions, comments? Yes. There is a sin that's called being too nice. You know, we all want to be nice. We don't want to be confrontational. Some of us like being confrontational, but many Christians think being nice is the ultimate virtue. It's not. And so what I tried to emphasize is that loving another person means doing good for them, and that takes wisdom. And sincerely, whatever your situation is, if you are aware of someone else's sin, do the Matthew chapter 7. Examine your own heart, your own desires, confess whatever sin God puts on your heart, and then try to see the other person's sin and how you can help them. You do know that Jesus taught us how to do church discipline. If you're the victim of a sin, what's the first thing you're supposed to do? Go to that person one-on-one. When I teach the new members class in Jaffrey, when we talk about church discipline, I say, you know, the first person who should hear about your being sinned against is the person who did it. Don't call me. If you call me and say, Joe sinned against me, I'm going to say, did you tell Joe? If you didn't tell Joe, go tell Joe. But there is a process. If the person does not repent, there is a process. And so that's where you bring in the elders or wise Christians, because you shouldn't do it alone. I mean, going it alone is not a good idea in a difficult situation where there's sin that's unrepentant. So I guess one of the things that I didn't emphasize here is this can be a community sort of event where you talk to someone who gives you wise counsel about the unrepentant sin in someone else's life. And that is very true. We need to encourage one another. And the encouragement might be just bouncing ideas off the other person, or it might be as profound as getting the elders or the pastor involved in confronting the person with their sin and then pursuing church discipline or whatever. Good question. Yes. I think it's good to err on the side of being careful, The idea of, I don't know if you've ever done this. I know someone who's struggling with, and you're talking about it's you, or my spouse. I know someone who's an angry person who says these things that she regrets. And she's a family physician who's married to a pastor in Jaffrey. But you can ask for anonymous help in the sense of saying, you know, how would you deal with someone? Some of you have already done this publicly. How would you deal with someone who's an unrepentant sinner? You could do that in a classroom situation. You can also do it one-on-one. But when you start naming names, that becomes something where you want to be careful you're not gossiping. And again, the first thing you need to do is go to the person who's sinned against you if you're dealing with a sin issue and confront them. And when you confront the person, it has to be done gently, wisely, right time, right place, and maybe even two or three times rather than just, oh, I called him on the phone, he just got out of the shower, he wouldn't talk to me. No, that doesn't count, all right? Thank you for that, Daniel. Has Jesus promised us there would be many difficult people as Christians or just a few? Many. If they hated Jesus, they're going to hate you. And Jesus also taught, be wise as serpents, but as innocent as doves. Which is a strange thing to say. You know, I mean, I've grown to understand you can't always believe what you hear. Kind of like trust, but verify what somebody is saying. Don't take things at face value sometimes. This is sort of another topic. In dealing with difficult people, you probably are going to be lied to or deceived in some way, and so you need to be wise in how you deal with that. And it's not an easy sort of solution. But be innocent, but also be wise as serpents. And they're going to hate you. People are going to hate you. You take a stand for purity at the office, purity of business relationships, sexual purity, all those kinds of things. That's totally countercultural. So you're going to find people are going to hate you. Talk about Jesus as Lord and Savior or whatever, and they may hate you for that too. So Jesus has said, expect difficult relationships. That wasn't the emphasis I had here in terms of this class, but they are going to hate you. For no reason. When you're a good Christian, you're going to be hated. Expect it, be prepared for it in a sense.